Watch what peanuts do to your waistline.
Celery with peanut.
In a wing of an ad.
From WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Valno with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, January 14th. New College of Florida cut down close to a dozen grand trees on land that belongs to Sarasota-Bradenton International Airport. WUSF first reported this incident, saying they included protected live oaks. A former operations director at the Sarasota Airport told WUSF the city requires the airport to file for permits before cutting down trees. The campus administration felt the trees next to the site of a proposed baseball field on the college's east campus near the intersection of the North Tamiami Trail and University Parkway, apparently without City of Sarasota permits. Construction of the $3.5 million ballpark cannot go ahead until the airport sells the land to New College or a new lease is negotiated with the airport authority. That's because the field would spill over onto airport-owned land. A college spokesman said the trees were cut down, quote, in compliance with applicable regulatory requirements. But Jono Miller, a former head of environmental studies at New College, called it, quote, preemptive destruction. Sarasota County Commissioner Joe Noonder has to face a fellow Republican to defend his seat in primary elections this summer. A retired Sarasota police sergeant filed as a candidate for the District 4 seat, which covers the Venice area. Jim DeNiro said he will focus on affordability, public safety, growth management, environmental protection, and greater accountability. He said he would scrutinize county spending. A Florida congressman filed a bill to annex Greenland and turn it into a U.S. state. U.S. Representative Randy Fine represents a Florida East Coast district, and his Greenland Annexation and Statehood Act comes as Donald Trump demands Denmark cede the territory to the United States. Secretary of State Marco Rubio informed Congress this month that he intends to meet with the Danish government about buying Greenland. The posh new resort on Longboat Key is offering guests to arrive by seaplane. For a starting price of $5,000, guests of the St. Regis Longboat Key Resort can now fly in from hydroplane bases in Miami and Palm Beach. Passengers on the pontoon-equipped Cessnas would land in Sarasota Bay near Ken Thompson Park, get transferred by boat, and picked up by a chauffeured Bentley to the St. Regis, where a personal butler and champagne await them. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, January 14th.
Good morning. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton. And my name is Bob Connors, and David Young is with me today, assisting me on the control board. I appreciate you being here, David.
Morning, Bob. How are you?
Good, thanks. Good. I'm going to begin the show after I mention that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. I do have a recorded interview to play in about 5 minutes or so, and I'll introduce the guest to you at that time, but I'd like to begin the show with something by Martin Luther King. This is way back when, in the 60s, and it's a commentary by Martin Luther King titled All Here and Now, All Here and Now. And Martin Luther King's birthday is tomorrow. It's amusing, David, over the years. I happen to have the same birth date as Martin Luther King. So when I mention that, they say, is it Monday? Is it No, his birthday isn't necessarily on a Monday. It could be on a Monday, but his actual birth date is January 15th. And after he was assassinated, I had heard they had mentioned when he was born, and it was January 15th, and I said, oh, my goodness, I have the same birth date as Martin Luther King, and I felt blessed that that was the case, and I don't hesitate to mention it, and the fact that I'm going to, today's the final day of my 78th year, David, final day of my 78th year.
Oh, my gosh. Happy birthday. Congratulations.
Do I look that old, David?
Oh, no.
79 years old.
You certainly don't act it.
79, no, I don't. Definitely don't act it, no. So, you know, David, I want to tell you how I began to be a member of the Peace and Justice Report. The station came into being in August of 2005. And one of the original shows was the Peace and Justice Report. You know, of course, Mark Binda had the very first show, you know, his Grateful Dead show, and way back when, in August 2005. So the Peace and Justice Report was on every other week, and Arlene Sweeting did one of the shows. And then the 2 weeks later, Don Thompson, Reverend Don Thompson and his wife did the other Peace and Justice Report. So this was in, as I mentioned, 2005. And in 2006, I began going to meetings at the library in Bradenton, the Coalition of Concerned Patriots. And Reverend Don Thompson was conducted that meeting, and, you know, usually it was 10 to 20 people. It was all about, how about the United States getting out of Iraq? We never should have been in there in the first place. And so I happened to meet Don Thompson. I knew he was, affiliated with the station, but I really hadn't talked to him that much. And after about several months' worth of meetings, he had mentioned, anybody want to join me in the Peace and Justice Report? I need my wife doesn't want to be my co-host any longer. And I immediately raised my hand, and I said, yes, I'd like to do that, Reverend Thompson. And the reason I brought Reverend Thompson up in 2005 is because he had taken workshops with Martin Luther King. Way back when, taking workshops with Martin Luther King. I think he even probably was on a march or two with him, but I can't say that unequivocally. So after Martin Luther King, even during those years, of course, Don Thompson passed away about 5 years ago, and we were on the Peace and Justice Report together for probably 7 or 8 years, and then following that, Tom Walker became my co-host. And the reason I brought this up, David, was, when Martin Luther King's name came up, a couple of times, Don Thompson, tears would come to his eyes, and, he'd actually cry. And I'm thinking, my goodness, it was so long ago that Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, at that time, it was in the early 2000s, so 40 years ago. Say this was 2006, 7, 8. In 1968 is when Martin Luther King was assassinated. But now, looking back on it, I fully understand the impact it had on Don, because he knew what a powerful, incredible, charismatic, eloquent spokesperson Martin Luther King was, and what a leader for the civil rights movement. And so it hit me. I said, now I understand why Don would cry when Martin Luther King's name came up. It almost brings tears to my eyes right now, David, because what we see going on in the U.S. today, I mean, and of course, Martin Luther King's famous speech at the Riverside Church, which took place in 1967, 1 year before he was assassinated, he called the United States the biggest purveyor of violence in the world. And he used Vietnam as an example. He used the treatment of minorities as an example. And he just went on in that speech. It's an incredible speech. the speech he gave at Riverside Church in 1 year before he was assassinated. And after that speech, people turned against Martin Luther King because he said, who is he to talk about Vietnam? I mean, he's a civil rights leader. I mean, there's no relationship. That's what they said. So when you look back at it, it's so amusing. That's the wrong word to use, but so frustrating, disappointing, distressing that what Martin Luther King saw in the 60s is happening right now, and it's been more or less the same ever since he left us. So I'm going to play just a three-minute commentary here by Martin Luther King, and the title of it is All Here and Now. Right on the line in, we'll expect this to come through loud and clear. If it doesn't, we'll put on a little music. Okay, here we go, All Here and Now. For some reason, I do not hear it, David. Let's see. I'm going to try it one more time. It seems to be playing where I am.
Let's start this piece, Shalom, Shalom.
Yeah, we'll put on Image Revolution and see. This is an opening song that we had on our show for many years by Image Revolution. Peace, Shalom, Shalom. And let's see. Is that coming on, David?
Bob?
Yeah.
My apologies. It's not starting here. I'll see if I can find it somewhere else.
Okay.
In the meantime, let's tell the folks about what's going on. Regarding the Martin Luther King.
The Martin Luther King Day WSLR in Fogartyville. This is Martin Luther King Day, of course. It's next Monday. It's always celebrated on a Monday. It's proud to sponsor the MLK Unity Walk in Sarasota. The walk takes place Monday, January 19th at the Robert L. Taylor Community Complex. Check-in begins at 10:30 a.m., and the walk steps off at 11. WSLR is forming a station group to participate, and community members, volunteers, programmers, and listeners are welcome to join us. The Unity Walk is part of a three-day celebration supporting scholarships for college-bound youth and honoring Dr. King's legacy through education, service, and community. More information can be found at WSLR.org. WSLR.org. So how's things looking now, David?
Otto Preminger, foremost independent producer of motion pictures, has said, and we quote, "I have great admiration for Dr. King. His spirit and devotion to these ideals, when translated into reality, will lead to full democracy, the greatest advancement for Americans of all creeds and colors that our country has ever known." Dr. King now responds to this observation with three little words. Three little words, that's all we live for. Three little words of big and great significance. Dr. Martin Luther King speaks of these three words. all here and now.
We don't need to utter but three words to tell this nation what we are talking about. They aren't big words. You don't need to have a great vocabulary to utter them. You don't need to have a philosophical bent to grasp them. They are three little words. But we want to let the world know that these words describe what we mean and what we are determined to do about racial injustice. One is the word all. We don't want some of our rights. We don't want a few token handouts here and there. We want all of our rights. The other word is here. There are some people who say that we need to go back to Africa. And then there are some others who tell Negroes in the South to leave the South. You can't be free, so get out. But down in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia and South Carolina, we are saying something else now. We want all of our rights, and we want all of our rights here in Alabama and Mississippi and South Carolina. And then there's a third word. It is the word now. We are not willing to wait 100 years for our rights. We are not willing to wait 50 years for what is ours on the basis of the Constitution of this United States and the authority of God Himself. No, we are not willing to wait another 25 years for our rights. We can hear voices telling us to slow up. We can hear voices telling us to cool off. Our only answer in calm, patient terms must be that we have cooled off too long, and if we keep cooling off, we'll end up in a deep freeze. We must go on and say, no, what we are saying to this nation is that we want all of our rights. We want them here, and we want all of them not next year, not next week. But we want them now, at this hour. This is what we're saying.
Yes, Martin Luther King, all here and now. So I'd like to mention that support for WSLR comes from listeners like you and from Manatee Spirit Holistic Sound Studio, offering sound-based wellness experiences in Bradenton. More information is available at 941-201-0069 or info@manateespirit.com. So as I mentioned earlier, I had an interview yesterday with Jeremy Kusmaroff. And Jeremy has been a guest on the show, probably 5 or 6 times over the last 5 or 6 years. I usually get in touch with him at least once a year, maybe twice. But he is one of the people who runs the website Covert Action, Covert Action Magazine. So Covert Action. So Jeremy has taught at numerous universities and colleges in the field of U.S. history and foreign relations. He has undertaken extensive specialized research on the following topics: COVID dimensions of U.S. foreign policy, the war on drugs, U.S. policing and prisons, and the internationalization of U.S. criminal justice, U.S. air power and its human cost, American military base networks, the false manipulations of the public in selling American wars, among other topics. He has contributed to many magazines over the years. He's written several books. And if you go to Covert Action Magazine, he usually has an article that comes out once a week, couple articles. So I had gone on his website the other day, and he has four pieces from the beginning of the year, and one of them was on Leonard Peltier. He lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He teaches college in Tulsa. And there was a documentary that was shown not that far from where he lives in Tulsa about a week or so ago. And he had gone to the documentary, watched it, and had asked Leonard Peltier a few questions over Zoom. And so I had read that piece, and I was really surprised to read some of the things that Leonard Peltier was subjected to over the years, how he happened to wind up in prison in the first place. So when I had the interview with Jeremy yesterday, that was the first question I had asked him. Well, let me see. Martin Luther King is coming back on. Let me tell Martin to leave the scene right now. There we go. Martin, we could listen to you all day. I know that much. So what I'm going to do is get this up and running so you can hear my interview with Jeremy yesterday.
Bob, real quickly, I'm going to interject that the views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or its volunteers.
Thank you very much, David. And here's Jeremy.
Well, there was a film screening where I live, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was a new documentary.
Bob, I'm not getting anything here. Let's cut the music just for a second.
Right.
Well, there was a film screening where I live, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and
that's why the train. Is the music playing? I can't tell.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Okay, here we go. It does take a couple of seconds for it just played.
Well, there was a film screening where I live, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was a new documentary about the case of Leonard Peltier. Well, there was a film screening where I live, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was a new documentary about the case of Leonard Peltier and how he was unjustly imprisoned and the activism among Native Americans and progressives to try and free him all this time. And it followed him as he, the Biden administration didn't pardon him, but did give him a sentence commutation. So he got out of prison. You know, he was put in prison around 1975. He was convicted. That was because he was part of the American Indian movement and they tried to reclaim land that had been stolen during the era of the Indian Wars, and they were planning to take even more of their reservation at that time. So he was there to defend, and he reiterated that the people of the Pine Ridge Reservation, Dakota, had invited the American Indian there to protect them. And he was involved in a shootout with some FBI officers who killed another member of the American Indian Movement, Joe Stuntz, on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And they saw them, that they were there to kill them and to precipitate a wider raid to destroy them. So they were trying to defend themselves. And actually, two FBI officers were tragically killed, Kohler and Williams. There are three people arrested, two of them, one of whom admitted to being the shooter. I believe it's in the article. I believe his name is Bob Robidoux, and there's another guy, I forget his name, but I think Robidoux or the other guy, one of the two, admitted to being the shooter of the FBI agents, and he actually said he was doing his duty and he was resisting their invasion, but he admitted to it. And he was actually acquitted on the grounds of self-defense. And even people in the FBI admitted that was the case, that they had been ambushed and the FBI had murdered this guy, Joe Stuntz. So, but then Peltier was basically an accessory because he was there. And he did admit, I believe, to firing at the FBI agent. But it's known that he's not the one who shot them. And actually, the FBI changed its story, because first they said that Peltier would have wanted to have killed the FBI agents. But then when the evidence was clear that he was not the one who shot them and killed them, they said, oh, he was an aider and abettor to the crime. However, Peltier in the interview said, well, how could you, if those two guys got off on self-defense, how could I be an aider and abettor? It's not a murder, it's self-defense. So it didn't add up to life sentences, let alone conviction. And I think the film emphasized, and also Peltier said, that the FBI was very upset after the first trial when these two American Indian activists were acquitted. So they really threw the book at Peltier, and they used a lot of dirty methods to get him convicted, like they coerced witnesses, and I don't know if they colluded with the judge, but the judge was found to have been very biased. He was very racist toward Indians, and he should have removed one of the jurors who made openly racist and inflammatory statements against Indian people, and that person should have been removed from the jury, but the judge didn't do that. And there were all kinds of problems with the trial. So that's a reason many feel that Peltier was unjustly incarcerated for decades. And he was also brutalized behind bars. He touched on this, that he was subjected to sensory deprivation, where they have the lights on 24 hours a day, and he doesn't know if it's night or day, and isolation. And solitary confinement for prolonged periods, and he's also reported that he faced beatings. And he said that the inmates that defended him were the Black Panther Party and the Irish Republican Army. But he did say that he thought he would die in prison, forgotten, and he's overwhelmed that people acknowledge him and he's received such warm support from the community. And they bought a house for him to stay in. Now he's under house arrest. He can't leave his property. He has to get permission, even for medical appointments. So, and he said it's very cold there. He's in Dakota. It's winter now. It's very cold. And he can't even go for a walk outside. At least in summer, he can walk around and get some fresh air and exercise. But it's a bit hard for him now in winter, so he's a bit isolated, and he's trying to get a pardon. The Biden administration refused to pardon him. Their official line was that he was guilty, when again, the trial was very dubious, and the claim that he's an aider and abettor to self-defense is highly questionable. So, but yeah, he was very sharp. It was nice to have an exchange with him because this event, he came on Zoom and interacting with the audience, and people could ask him questions. And he was very sharp. You know, he's a guy in his 80s, and he has some health ailments such as diabetes. I think he suffered for a long time and declining vision. He's not blind, but he does have some issues with his vision. But he was very sharp in answering the questions, and he had astute political observation. He was describing the situation in Gaza, what they did to Native Americans, trying to steal their land and resources and using violence. He just said there are different weapons now, but that's what they've done to us. And he had a lot of good observations, and he was also discussing some. I asked him about his time in a boarding school, because the film touched on some of his background, and he was sent to one of these boarding schools as a youth, and he said that he was being raised by his grandmother, and the film, the director was also there and said that part of the aim of the documentary was to just humanize him, show him as a regular human being. And he's kind of a jokester. And he was very well regarded in the Native community as a very kind person. He was a mechanic, and he was known for helping whoever needed help with the car. He said he wanted to be a musician, but his family couldn't afford, he grew up in dire poverty. They couldn't afford a guitar. And he ended up being an artist, and he was known for painting murals. And he did a lot of painting while he was in prison, but he did a lot of political murals before he went to prison. So it just showed his human qualities, and he discussed a bit his experience in the boarding schools, and said they beat him there. You know, he was a kind of rebellious child. He didn't take to the schooling. And they beat him, and he tried to escape, and he said they almost got killed because he was trying to run across the river in winter, and I guess the ice started to crack, and he nearly drowned. So it was, we got a sense of how terrible that experience was, the boarding schools, how cruel they were treated. And he also discussed the attacks on the American Indian movement and other Indian, how the Nixon administration, FBI, gave weapons, and that's something the film addressed. And yeah, this is a great documentary called, I think, Free Leonard Peltier, and it shows how the FBI gave weapons to these basically Native turncoats under the chief of the reservation, Dick Wilson, and they were attacking. They used the weapons to attack and kill members of the American Indian movement. And Peltier said that they were, there are a lot of traitors in Native American history. They would be easily bribed by the white man and, accept the weapons and, some money or alcohol and kill other Indians and do the dirty work of the U.S. military or, U.S. political establishment. He was commenting on that, and this Dick Wilson, what a traitor he was, and he had a sharp memory and a sharp analysis that was very illuminating to hear.
Well, that was great that you got a chance to meet him, because you live in Tulsa, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
And that's where
Tulsa has a lot of Native American, because the five tribes resettled in Oklahoma, so there are a lot of Native Americans, and they have events periodically like this one, which was very very good to attend. Yeah.
So I know that you posted a piece. It looks like it was just yesterday or the day before. The CIA facilitated drug trafficking through cartel. Trump administration falsely accuses Maduro of controlling. Can you give us an idea of what you found out and what's in that piece?
Sure. Well, the Trump administration, issued an indictment after kidnapping the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro, and it claims that Maduro is head of this drug cartel, the Cartel of the Suns, although now it's acknowledged, and I think even in that indictment it's acknowledged that this is not a real cartel. It's basically a reference to certain corrupt military officers who wore a sun insignia on their uniform, and they were part of a certain network in the military. It's not an actual drug cartel, but a video surfaced, actually 60 Minutes did a report in the mid-90s how the CIA had worked with the Cartel of the Sun back in that time, and they were actually trafficking cocaine into the United States, that the CIA had an operation with this General Guillen, who was with the Cartel of the Suns, and, you know, they said that the purpose of the drug trafficking operation was to gain some kind of credibility with the Colombian cartel that they were trying to bring down. But it's very suspicious. You know, the DEA basically was unhappy and trying to block what they're doing, and they went over the head of the DEA. And actually, some of the drugs were seized at Miami Airport, but this guy, Guillen, had his indictment. I think he was indicted, but then it was mysteriously dropped. You know, and the CIA was protecting him, and I made the point that probably they were raising revenue through that drug trafficking operation to fund dirty war operation in Venezuela, because Guillen was part of the far right, and he was implicated in the early 2000s in an assassination attempt against Hugo Chavez. And the drug operation we're going forward was right after the Caracazo, which was a major uprising in 1990 in Venezuela and against the neoliberal and austerity policies, and it was brutally suppressed. And that was a time when the left-wing movements were revitalized, because in the 60s and 70s, there was a very vibrant left-wing movement in Venezuela. And the U.S., and as I detailed in my book, Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century, in a chapter on Latin America, the Office of Public Safety was run out of USAID. They trained foreign police forces often in counterinsurgency and repressive tactics, and they were very active in Venezuela, supporting a center-right government that upheld the interests of foreign oil corporations, including the Creole Oil Petroleum Company, which was a subsidiary of Standard Oil, was later ExxonMobil. So the Venezuelan left was largely crushed in the 60s and 70s, but then with the help of U.S. police training programs and the importation of a lot of military technology and creation of blacklists and torture, but then it regenerated after the Caracazo uprising. You had a neoliberal program in the 80s. I think they actually did try and nationalize the oil industry in the mid-70s, but then they reverted to more privatization, neoliberalism. Then, huge economic disparities and resurgence of the left. And then that was crushed when you had the Caracazo. So these CIA operations coincided at a time when the left was revitalizing in the 90s, and that's when Hugo Chavez emerged as a key leader within the military, and that's something that the CIA and U.S. government was, monitoring and, developing plans to suppress. So I think the drug trafficking operations fit with a larger political objective, and it was used to raise revenue. And that fits a pattern in U.S. political history where they've used the drug trade to finance dirty wars, like, or wars against the left, like, or surveillance states, like in Laos and the Indochina Wars. There's a well-documented case of the CIA support for the Hmong private army that was financed in large part through drug trafficking carried out by the CIA, which set up a bank in Australia, the Nugan Hand Bank, for money laundering purposes. And then you had the Contra War in the 80s, and Gary Webb exposed how the countries were flooding U.S. cities like Los Angeles with cocaine and using revenue from the drug trade to fund their dirty operations against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So that there is precedence. So I think this fits with the pattern of U.S. foreign policy strategy in the CIA, and it shows the farce of today that they claim they want to stop the drug trade, and that's just an excuse to go into Venezuela, kidnap their socialist president, and try and open the country to the oil interests.
So do you have any thoughts on what will happen from here on out with Venezuela and the oil and the current president who was sworn in after they got rid of Maduro?
Well, it's hard to predict. I don't know exactly. I mean, there's some question marks about this. On one hand, it seemed that the U.S. Succeeded in kidnapping Maduro, but they haven't destroyed the regime, the socialist government. And Delcy Rodriguez, was part of that government. The rest of the government is still intact. I mean, that was a government voted in by the Venezuelan people. They proclaim Maduro still their legitimate president. And I think they want to continue, the Bolivar Revolution, which aimed to establish an economically and politically sovereign country with control over its own natural resource of oil. On the other hand, the country has been severely weakened, by the economic warfare that the U.S. has carried out has severely destroyed, weakened their economy, and the government may be in an ever more desperate position. such have to acquiesce, as far as welcoming foreign dollars and foreign interests. And then there's the question of Delcy Rodriguez. Is she compromised in any way, or are there other elements of the government? I mean, it's known that the CIA paid off people to enable that raid to occur. So the question becomes, who were those people? And if they're at the top of the government, are they going to work to sabotage the interests of the Venezuelan people? And they're also facing threat. Trump has threatened them with more attacks. He's seizing oil tankers, and he's carrying out basically terroristic activity and pirate activity. But they may be backed into a corner where they feel intimidated that they have to acquiesce to what the U.S. wants, or that the U.S. will totally destroy the country or move forward with a full-fledged military attack. And as much as they can count on the Venezuelan population, I think, to defend the country and government, on the other hand, the economy is very, very weak now because of the years of sanctions, and there may be some eroded legitimacy of the government. I mean, I think part of the intent of the sanctions was to get the people to turn against their government and to blame the government for all the problems. And sometimes that does work. I mean, if you look at Syria, the U.S. was able to achieve regime change. It was a long, it didn't happen overnight, but they used the sanctions to devastate Syria's economy and to delegitimize the Assad government, or at least to put the population in such a desperate situation that they just wanted the lifting of the sanctions. And even if they would prefer Assad or Maduro, who are more authentic nationalist leaders, their main priority was survival and to end the sanctions on their country so they could resume normal economic life and actually eat proper meals. And so it weakened the resolve of the people to be able to defend those governments. And some may be willing to acquiesce to regime change if, again, it means eating properly or going back to a normal life. So this strategy of the U.S. could succeed over the short and long term, as it did in Syria. The U.S., they're patient. The vested economic interests, the neoconservatives who run the show, they play the long game, and they're not going to give up. Their goals are being changed, and they'll do everything to achieve that goal. If it takes 5 more years, that's nothing for them. They're planning, and you know, there's too much wealth at stake. And also, I think if they can get more oil out of Venezuela, you could also look at the situation in the Middle East. They can carry forward more aggressively with regime change and military operation in Iran. If they're confident they have a lot of oil from Venezuela, they'll be less concerned, say, if Iran tries to cut off the flow of the Straits of Hormuz, which is a huge transfer point of oil. But if the U.S. know they're getting the oil from Venezuela, they're a bit less concerned about that or instability, at least temporary instability in the Middle East if they're pursuing a regime change. So that's, I think, how the neoconservatives think. They're aggressive militarists, arch-imperialists. And, I mean, it's clearly reflected that this guy, Stephen Miller, as bad a guy as he is, he says the way they think, and that the world is run through brute force, and that it's our oil for the taking, basically.
Yeah.
And that's the philosophy. I mean, it's not very sophisticated. It's just kind of caveman, law of the jungle. And that's what they're doing. I mean, these groups, we've seen the crime they've carried out among the greatest crimes in history, really, since the Nazi era. And they seem to have no regard for human life, for the rule of law. They just want more and more wealth and power for themselves. And I think they are sick human beings, but on the other hand, human nature, unfortunately, has been like that for a long time, so they may not be that unique, but they have carried on a reign of terror throughout the world, and they're more and more authoritarian here domestically, and I think we have to rise up against these tyrannical people who are running our government.
Yes.
That's we're listening to Jeremy Kusmaroff of Covert Action Magazine. And there's one more question I ask him that's coming up right now. There's a book he had written a year or so ago titled Warmonger, How Clinton's Malign Foreign Policy Launched the U.S. Trajectory from Bush to Biden. So I'll put that back on.
There's kind of a long pattern of continuity in U.S. foreign policy. And I think, the Clinton administration eviscerated the rule of law and carried out a lot of reckless military invasions. I mean, you can look at the ball, and this is what the book goes into. Well, actually, it starts with the premise that there was a moment of opportunity with the end of the Cold War. That has provided justification for the huge military budgets and the permanent warfare state. And now the Cold War is over. And actually, it was Robert McNamara, architect of the Vietnam War, an arch Cold Warrior, who spoke before Congress, and he said, now the Cold War is over, we can cut the military budget by a third and actually spend, on education and health care and really improve our society. Robert McNamara said that. And unfortunately, Bill Clinton came along, and, it took somebody like Clinton, who was a phony liberal, to have this rhetoric of humanitarian intervention to provide a justification for the basically revitalization and expansion of the military-industrial complex at the end of the Cold War, and to not go forward with McNamara's sensible idea and more humane vision of governance. So Clinton created a new pretext that we have to go and stop genocide. And, the veneer that he had been part of the anti-war movement, I think there was a carefully cultivated image, of him as this kind of hippie-type guy out of the 60s. And, in fact, Jan Wenner, who was a editor of Rolling Stone magazine, a founder of that magazine, who was part of the counterculture movement, he said in 1992, he wrote an op-ed in Rolling Stone saying, oh, finally we have somebody of our generation, you know, vote for Clinton. And I said, I think Clinton, it was a coup for the military complex because they got all these 60s people to believe Clinton was one of them. And that's, I mean, a marker in some ways of an effective politician who can make people think he's with them, but he's not really with them. And Clinton was very good at doing that. He could speak to different audience and win the audience, and they think he's with them. But really, he's with the corporate masters all along. If you look at his career, which I do in the book, you know, and I, the first chapters examine, and I did a lot of research on this, including libraries in Arkansas. You know, I live on right near Arkansas, so I went there quite often, and I interviewed whistleblowers and stuff. So, you know, those first chapters deal with when he was the governor of Arkansas, and he was closely aligned with the major economic forces that dominate the state at that time, and I think mostly still do, Walmart, Tyson Chicken, and a Stevens Investment House, which is the largest hedge fund outside of Wall Street. It was also connected with the CIA. So that's who his real, you know, masters were, and that he enacted policy that satisfied them, but he created the illusion that he was this liberal populist and hippie type. And so when he became president, he promoted this rhetoric of humanitarian intervention and helped get liberals and the former protesters of Vietnam to think this was a humanitarian cause, to bomb Bosnia and Kosovo. But really, you know, in the end, the U.S. acquired more military bases, and, you know, it was a way to break up Yugoslav Federation under Tito, had been an independent, you know, socialist country, and the U.S. had designs on the region, so the bombing of Kosovo and the Bosnia helped to achieve the goal of breaking up Yugoslavia into different countries and enabling more U.S. you know, corporate penetration and establishment of military bases. And, you know, a lot of Clinton's wars were more covert. Like in Central Africa, he was covertly supporting Rwanda and Uganda. They invaded the Congo and, you know, plundered its mineral wealth. And, you know, he was bombing Sudan. He was, well, some of the chapters deal with the, and then that was a completely lawless action where he bombed the pharmaceutical plant in Sudan and caused a real humanitarian crisis. And he was using the pretext of, you know, fighting terrorism. And I have a chapter on the war on terror that show how he really escalated. You know, he set the groundwork for the horrors of the Bush years by really escalating the war on terror and using the fight against terrorism as a pretext for expanded, you know, military intervention in the Middle East, like bombing Iraq, bombing Sudan, expanding U.S. military facilities, you know, empowering certain kinds of governments. And he pioneered the use of thing like extraordinary rendition that became famous under Bush, or infamous. It actually started under Clinton when they would kidnap suspects. You know, so they completely did away with due process and civil liberties by kidnapping suspects without actually having them tried in the court and then taking them to countries where known, where the police were known for their brutality, like Hosni Mubarak's Egypt. So he started that process. So there are a lot of things that were, you know, very ugly about his foreign policy, but he still sustained this reputation as kind of progressive, undeservedly. And I think now his reputation is waning because of the Epstein stuff. That's fine. I mean, I actually show his own personal conduct was horrific. Going back, you know, to an early period. In fact, he never, you know, he was a student at Oxford. He was a Rhodes Scholar, but a lot of people don't know he never actually graduated because he was accused of sexual assault then of a girl at the school. And he was repeatedly accused of sexual assault, and there's strong evidence that he was a rapist and a sexual predator who was known for biting the lips of the women. That was his trademark. To weaken them, he bit their lips. And their mysterious deaths. And you know, I interviewed a lot of people in Arkansas and they, you know, he's hated in the state. And sometimes they mock those people. I find, like, in liberal circles, they just say, oh, they're backward, you know, they're from Arkansas. But a lot of them are very good people, and they have real grounds for hating Clinton, both of them. You know, unfortunately, in American life, we're getting the worst people as leaders. So we have to, I think, seriously think, how do we get these monsters, whether it's, you know, sexual predators. I mean, you know, Trump is a horrible human being. He's probably a child rapist. There seems to be evidence of that, among other terrible things. I mean, I couldn't conceive of a worse human being than Trump. What we see on a daily basis is just absolutely horrific. And anti-intellectual, you know, misogynist. But, you know, Clinton was not that much better. So, I mean, you know, the scale of Trump is the absolute bottom of the barrel of humanity from my point of view. Yeah. And Clinton's basically, I would put him about the same category
right.
as Trump. So I don't know how we get just the absolute worst of the worst.
Right.
You know, something has gone seriously wrong.
Well, it gives you plenty to write about, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Jeremy, I really appreciate your being available this afternoon, and I'm going to mention some of your other books to the audience tomorrow. So thanks again, and hopefully you'll be available in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, Jeremy. We'll talk to you again.
Okay.
That was Jeremy Kusmaroff of Covert Action magazine, written many books, many, many articles, and I was happy to have him available yesterday afternoon. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. And Jeremy has a wealth of knowledge. He spends so much time researching. It's incredible. But I want to mention that there's... the Sarasota School Board is meeting next Tuesday at 10 a.m. at 1980 Landings Boulevard. I'm sure you probably know where it is, right past the Landing Shopping Center. 10 a.m. next Tuesday. And there's one on the agenda. There's one resolution that is looking to be passed by the school board. I just want to read it. The Sarasota County and School Board and Sarasota County Police Department hereby commits to full cooperation and collaboration with all local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies, including but not limited to local, municipal, and county agencies. Florida State authorizes the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in the lawful execution of their duties. No additional barriers, policies, or directives beyond those required by law shall be imposed by the school board, its members, or district employees that could hinder or delay lawful law enforcement actions on school property. No school board member, employee, contractor, volunteer, or representative shall impede, obstruct, or interfere with the lawful actions of any law enforcement agency, including U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Any such conduct shall be deemed a violation of their resolution, excuse me, district policy, and potentially applicable laws, subjecting the individual to disciplinary action up to and including termination, as well as referral for criminal investigation if warranted. Sarasota County Schools reaffirms that its campuses as dedicated to education and shall not be used as a safe haven for criminals, ensuring that all interactions with law enforcement prioritize student safety and legal compliance while minimizing educational disruptions. So that is going to be, that's on the agenda this coming Tuesday. So if you're interested in that subject matter, you might want to get down to the Landings at 10 a.m. on Tuesday. And what do we have, a few seconds left, David?
Yeah, it's just a minute left. Remember, there was a Matt Pond show tonight at Fogartyville. Just a few tickets left, and we checked it before we went on the air. We've also got the Martin Luther King Jr. Day walk next Monday. Come join us, if you would. We'd sure appreciate it. Everybody have a great week. Bob, thanks for letting me sit down.